Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Curtis Sittenfeld, author of You Think It, I'll Say It, Stories, published in April by Random House. Curtis is the best-selling author of 5 novels. Those books have been selected by the New York Times, Time, Entertainment Weekly, and People for many 10 best lists. They've been optioned for TV and film and translated into 30 languages. Her short stories have appeared in the Washington Post, Esquire, and her nonfiction has appeared in the New York Times, Time, Vanity Fair, The Atlantic, and Slate. In this first collection, Curtis writes stories about from anything from Donald Trump. And personally, I wake up every morning and my first thought is, Donald J. Trump is president of the United States of America, which starts my day off really horribly, but has nothing to do with this book. And she has a package of other short stories that deal with women in right now America, all navigating this present and complicated culture with its norms, new norms, and weirdness, and allows these protagonists to deal with friendship, deceit, family, politics, as I mentioned, and of course, social media. Their stories are sad, poignant, funny, triumphant at times, and tragic at others. In all, the great thing about these stories is that we feel after reading each that we have dealt with a real person and a real story, which I think makes a great author. So welcome, Curtis, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, well, in these 10 stories, what were you trying to tell us about women in the modern world? That's a big question.
Everything. I was trying to tell you everything. I don't think that I have a particular sort of non-fictional thesis statement underlying my stories, because if I did, I would probably write a non-fiction essay. But I think I'm just more exploring what it feels like for certain segments of the population to be alive right now in the United States.
Well, like if you go, and we don't have to go through all of them, but I kind of like to.
We can. It's okay. your show.
Yeah, I like doing it. So, like the first one, gender studies. And the question I had really was, how did and why did you decide to let Trump get into the story in the first place? Because, you know, like there's this site called What the F Just Happened Today. It's a great website, and every day there's just more and more stuff. Like the other day, his Memorial Day tweet. But you obviously have a, you know, it's funny. I've interviewed all these authors, and authors are pretty intelligent, and everyone has had the same kind of opinion about Trump. But you seem to have the same one. But why decide to insert it in this contemporary story?
Well, so a funny thing about that story is the premise of it is that there's a woman who is a professor of gender studies, and she's on a work trip. She teaches in Wisconsin, and she's traveled to Kansas City for a sort of meeting with other academics. And she's a passenger in a shuttle from the airport to the hotel. She's the only passenger. She and the shuttle driver kind of start talking, or he starts talking to her more than it's a, like, mutual or reciprocal conversation. And he shares some of his thoughts about Trump. He's a Trump supporter. She's not. As they part, she, of course, thinks, I'll never see this guy. You know, that guy was annoying, and I'll never see him again. And then she believes that she has left her driver's license, or may have left her driver's license, in the shuttle. And so she finds him and asks him if she has, and then they end up sort of reconnecting. And this is not to make myself sound like, I mean, like, I feel like I am the kind of controller of my own fiction, so I'm not trying to be like, I don't know what I'm doing, and I just follow my instincts. But that said, I definitely conceived of this as a story about a woman who loses her driver's license, and not as a sort of political allegory about the 2016 election. And in fact, I wrote it, and it was published in The New Yorker in August 2016. So Trump had not been elected. And it's a funny story. I mean, not funny, ha-ha, but it's a funny story in terms of the way its meaning changes, you know, when it was first published in a magazine and when it's published in a book in 2018. But essentially, you know, I think that I just sort of wanted to write about this woman who loses her license, and I kind of had her, had them making small talk about Trump, and then it turned out to be a more kind of defining aspect of the story than I had planned.
It's like what happens on Saturday Night Live, you know, like a year and a half ago or 2 years ago or 3 years ago. They had these skits that seemed to be, okay, they're right on the money, and then now when you look back at them, you realize they were totally wrong about so many things, and now because he's such a satire of himself, it's almost impossible, you know, to write anything about him that's funny. And
yeah. It is interesting. I mean, it's interesting how any, I think, you know, piece of art or piece of fiction or whatever changes. Like, the meaning of something can change so much because of external circumstances, even though the thing itself hasn't changed.
Yeah, and what's so scary to me, and I don't mean to go off on this, and I know we're trying to sell your book, because there's, you know, apparently, my brother always says, I always say to my brother, how did this happen? And he goes, because there's half of the people that think this way, and there's half of the people that think that way. And he's right. But it is, you know, interesting that that what happened happened, and it is interesting that when you wrote it, it hadn't happened yet. I think that's fascinating.
Yeah. No, that's an interesting way to put it. But I'm not totally convinced by your brother's logic. Like, I mean, I think there were, it seems like there was also, you know, Russian meddling.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
And it's not, I mean, if you're talking about half of voters, it's actually more than half of voters did vote for Hillary Clinton. Like, I think I look at the 2016 election as, you know, I believe that there was a 93% chance that Hillary Clinton was expected to win, and that almost like 17 different things had to happen in order that were all somewhat unlikely and like super unlikely for all of them in order for Donald Trump to win. And like all 17 of them did happen.
I agree with you 100%.
It still feels like if any one thing had fallen slightly differently, you know, it would have been like closer than people thought, but she might have won.
Well, if you go back to Bush, for example, who I now think of as like an elder statesman.
Yeah, like an elegant, sophisticated, very intellectual. Yeah,
and that was, you know, again, yeah. Well, I was thinking, I remembered this quote by Mussolini, which applies really well now, which is, if you pluck a chicken one feather at a time, no one notices.
Yeah.
I think that's,
yeah, I mean, it's sort of the, also, I think this is not scientifically accurate, but like, if you, you know, put a frog in a boiling pot of water, it jumps out, but if you put it in a cold pot of water and then slowly boil it, it just sort of sits there. It's, I think we are all the frogs in that analogy.
It's really scary. We're really scared.
I know. I agree. This is festive. Thanks for selling so many copies of my story.
All right. I'll go. Let's just talk about Luke.
I'm kidding. We can talk about whatever you want to.
No, we'll talk about Luke, because, you know, what you do is you write these characters, and I'm not quite sure, you know, whether I like them, whether I dislike them, and it's like, you know, it's like in Volunteers or Shining Stars. I'm thinking, well, Elena, what do I like her? Do I dislike her? And I'm not quite sure. I mean, she has her issues and all, but I'm not sure if she's not right about Francis. Not Francis. Francis. Yeah, Francis.
Yeah. I know. There's a lot of characters.
I know.
If it's a short story collection, it's like there's, you know, like 10 times more characters than usual to keep track of. Well, you know, I actually take what you're saying as a compliment, because I think that, you know, we as people tend to feel more engaged with others, weirdly, if we don't know what we think of them. Like, if you're like, you know, I really dislike that person, then you kind of just, I think, can dismiss them and maybe try to avoid them. But if you are kind of in this ongoing process of trying to figure out if you like or dislike someone, it's like, it's kind of disturbing to the brain, yet like engaging.
Yeah, and what happens is your stories make the reader work. And, you know, some readers, you know, don't want that. They want, you know, to end up in a wrapped up present with a bow and all that. And your stories make it difficult to do that. So when you hand them over, when you hand over your children to the public, they are required, you know, to decide for themselves. And I think that's always another mark of a really good book is, you know, I need to think about whether Luke was a good guy and also whether he was betrayed. And I think...
Yeah. No, I want my stories to be open to interpretation. And in some cases, you know, apropos of social media, people will reach out to me and say, okay, but, like, which person is correct? Like, in the story, plausible deniability, there's sort of, or in the story The World Has Many Butterflies, there's sort of two characters who have different interpretations of their interactions, even though they'd probably describe their interactions the same way, but then they'd draw different conclusions about what they mean. And I feel like if someone says on Twitter, like, okay, but who's right? I tweet back that, like, shrugging emoji, where it's like, actually, you get to decide who's right.
Yeah, a lot of it's like Molière, you know, it's like, or Seinfeld. These issues, they're based on misunderstandings that the misunderstanding either yields a comic or a tragic or a sad or a happy outcome. Like in Plausible Deniability, one guy is thinking something means something, and the other person either means it or doesn't mean it.
Yeah.
And then ends it, but do you think it really ends, or maybe she backs off and decides, well, you know what, maybe I like what I'm doing.
And that's a good question. I think that again, you know, like, like if you said, well, okay, this is something that might happen after the story ends, that's not even like an explicit compliment. Like, it's not saying this is a great story or like this is a beautiful story or something like that. But something I take that as a compliment, that it's like, well, I kind of want to know what happened next, or I'm kind of going to fill it in for myself. Like, it does, you know, again, it sort of lodges in someone's brain.
Well, if this ends up as a movie or as a Netflix series that stretches out over 7 seasons, like, who knows what they'll do with Plausible Deniability? Because when she's up in the window at the end, turned away, and he's not quite sure, they're going to have to... I don't know. You know, you could continue it.
You could. By the way, it's the book was optioned by Reese Witherspoon, her production company, Hello Sunshine, for Apple TV, not for Netflix. But so what you're describing could come to pass. I mean, I'm sort of tangentially involved, so I don't know that I can control the outcome. But
yeah, it's funny. You could have Reese Witherspoon, you know, kind of starring in all the parts, because she has that look where she could easily emulate many of these women. That would be a good idea. Do the series just with her as the protagonist.
I hear she has like a totally free schedule, so it can be like one of those Eddie Murphy movies where he plays like 8 different characters.
Like the other guy who does Medea, I've forgotten his name.
Who
does that? What's her name? You know, is it Medea, the one who does a Medea Christmas?
Oh yeah. Tyler Perry.
Couldn't think of his name. So in Plausible Deniability, music obviously takes up a big part of it. Is that something that's, you know, kind of part of you, and you decided that these pieces meant what they meant?
So actually, that's that piece represents sort of a departure. On the one hand, I feel like I listen to music a lot, and, you know, derive a lot of pleasure from it, and, you know, sort of find it like emotionally comforting or exhilarating or whatever. All that said, the story you're describing, you know, it's a man and a woman are sending these emails to each other, which are almost exclusively about pieces of classical music that they like and why they like them. And there's sort of other stuff going on, maybe or maybe not, but they are the only explicit, you know, conversation they're having in writing is about music. And I know very, very little about music, but I have a neighbor who plays in the St. Louis Symphony, and I basically said to her, will you tell me some of your favorite pieces of classical music and why you like them? And she wrote these emails, and I then kind of, you know, cut and pasted and added sentences and cut sentences, but she literally wrote some of the sentences in those emails, and I do credit her by name. Her name is Beth Guterman Chu, and I credit her in the acknowledgments. Like, I would not pretend to have written something that I hadn't. And then I also, actually, one of the people, there's one correspondent in the email exchange who knows a lot about classical music, and she kind of supplied me with that person's emails. And then there's another person who's, you know, a fan of classical music, but never played an instrument or isn't knowledgeable in the almost professional level. And I actually, some of those come from me basically like interviewing my husband about why he likes particular pieces of music. So that's how the sausage got made in that story.
Well, it comes across as very genuine. And it also, once again, lays the onus on the reader because, you know, those pieces of music can mean what they mean, but they can also carry, whether they can carry lust, they can carry love, they can carry erotic messages. And
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so this misunderstanding or this what I consider, I don't know, not tragic, what is it? I don't know what the word is, but like if you take The World Has Many Butterflies, from which the title of this book came, how could Julie have been so mistaken? And, you know, how does that, because of that mistake, the idea of the magic of butterflies leaves her? Did she not believe in their magic or their number because of the mistake she made regarding a relationship? Or was it the obverse, you know, did she never believe in that and that's why she made this mistake? You know what I mean?
I don't know. Emoji shrug. I don't know.
Well, okay, so
is that not a satisfying answer?
No, because it's not satisfying because, yeah, I don't expect you to answer it, but I guess in this, I don't know how you're going to take this, but in each of these stories, I find that there's an element of betrayal, every one of them. So you can shrug at that or allow me to feel that or say that I'm wrong, but it seems like in each one, whether it's Bad Latch, you know, there's this sense that this woman is betraying this other woman, but then in the end, it turns out she's actually not. But there's this kind of heavy feeling that somebody is not getting what they deserve. And in all of them, it's women.
That's interesting. Oh, so even because two of the stories basically have male protagonists. You know, one is first person and one is third person. But it's interesting that it's the woman who doesn't get what she deserves. You mean in the sense of, like, she deserves something good that she doesn't get as opposed to something bad that she doesn't get?
Yeah, but it's a betrayal because he never meant what she thought he meant. So
right. I mean, I think it's, I don't know. I think that what you're asking is an interesting question. And so it's not, I'm kidding about the emoji shrug, but strangely, like, I feel like if someone says to me, you know, describe your own fiction or, like, tell me what the themes are in your fiction, it's almost like if I said to you, describe your own personality, where you are not, weirdly, you're not necessarily the most credible source. You're almost, like, too close to it to say. And so I kind of feel like it's my job, or, like, I'm, you know, it's my privilege that I get to write stories and write fiction, and then other people can kind of say what they're about. I mean, certainly, like, in the more concrete way, I feel conscious of there being like this repetition of themes. Like, I wouldn't say it. I'm not actually disagreeing with you, but if someone said, "What's a book about?" I wouldn't say betrayal. Like, I would say, well, you know, there's some stories about sort of celebrity and the ambivalence about celebrity in our culture, and there's some stories about, you know, like the complications of marriage, and there's some stories where like one woman sort of semi-irrationally hates another woman, and so it's almost like describing them more concretely and less thematically, but I don't know, at the same time, like, I'm certainly not disagreeing that betrayal is a kind of through line in the stories.
Well, look, let me pick one at random. If you take The Prairie Wife, okay, Casey and Lucy have this relationship, and just when Casey's about to get back at Lucy, Lucy pulls the rug out from under her. So Casey and the guy she hangs out with for this very purpose, feels that she's been betrayed, even though there's really no betrayal at all. Right?
That's an interesting interpretation. I mean, I think that it's almost like, again, I'm not disagreeing, and I feel like I sort of like the point when my stories, like, there is a time when I'm sitting in my office and I'm writing stories, and no one has read the story except for me. So it's, like, completely mine. And it's almost like, you know, I control 100% of anyone's interpretation about it. And then, you know, it like, I show it to my early readers, like my friends, and I show it to my editor and my agent and, you know, other people at my publishing house. And then it sort of gets published and goes into the wider world. And I kind of like when it gets released and is not totally like there's something fun about when it's my own little like private secret thing, and then there's something nice when it's like public and almost no longer my responsibility in the sense that I can't change it, and so I feel like if you were to say to me, you know, is that an act of betrayal, like I would more see the end of The Prairie Wife as like one person being more complicated and nuanced than another person expects. And I like that because I feel like, I don't know, it can be very tempting to see other people in a sort of reductive way and to think that other people are one-dimensional, but they're not. I mean, we're all very complicated. And another, I mean, I did have this realization probably in the last, like, 2 or 3 years, which is kind of belated, given that I'm 42 and this is my 6th book, but that I like to write about smart characters who incorrectly assess situations or themselves. And that it's like, to me, that's much more interesting than, you know, dumb characters who incorrectly assess situations or intelligent characters who correctly assess situations.
Well, it's like, okay, if you take Off the Record, which in some ways is like The Prairie Life, there, again, I would say, who's betraying who? You know, this woman's going to write a story, and then all of a sudden something happens that makes the story not a story anymore.
Yeah. I agree that there is a betrayal in that story.
And it's like, but then, okay, then you take A Regular Couple, and that's one where finally this was one where, and it's really funny because you reverse it. In this one, I know exactly what tying a shoe means. You know?
Yep.
It's like, okay, that one, I don't have to think about that anymore.
Yep. Oh, you mean so it's more conclusive than the other story?
It's very conclusive. It has a beginning, middle, and an end.
You're welcome.
But, you know, yeah, and you do it in a very concrete way, but using deus ex machina of the running shoe.
Thank you.
And then that was, well, and that's, okay, actually, that's not true. I can't wrap that one up, because I don't know if back when, the way she treated her with the shoe the first time really was what the other woman thought it was. No one who's listening to this understands what the hell I'm talking about.
I know. I actually was just thinking this, that this is like... The
but I don't care.
It might be much more interesting to listen to this if you have read the book than if you haven't read the book.
But I think it still sounds like it's interesting to me.
If you haven't read the book, turn this off immediately. I think that what you're saying is kind of an interesting question. Like it's like, if I think that you wronged me, and so I sort of like, you know, get revenge, but actually you didn't wrong me, then I'm the one who's like doubly wrong, you know, like I shouldn't have gotten revenge ever. Like it wasn't like an act of sort of balancing the scales. It was just like a sort of purely cruel thing to do.
Has anything like this ever happened to you?
What do you mean by this?
Well, you know, I've lumped all these things all together into this concept of misunderstanding, betrayal, and whatever. I mean, have you ever found yourself in a position where, whether it was like a girlfriend, not a girl, a girlfriend in the sense of college girlfriends, whether it was a girlfriend or whether it was someone you met later in life where you misunderstood the relationship, or you thought you misunderstood it in some way and in actuality it was a different way?
Well, it's interesting. That's an interesting question, because I think, you know, you've been saying like that in some ways the stories, I don't know, maybe like lack closure, or you're not sure how to interpret them. And I think that that's a phenomenon in real life, where you can think like, okay, you know, you I think you can sort of know if you and another person like really don't like each other. You can probably tell, or if you and another person really do like each other. But then there can be some middle ground.
You're listening to 1520 AM WCAG.
I don't know. You just you might feel like you don't, but you never really know, because there are these things that to really clarify and understand someone else's mindset would be to need to ask questions that are kind of like a social violation. You can't, like, after you're in, I don't know, like third grade or seventh grade or something, you can't really say, do you like me? And certainly in adulthood, I've been surprised where maybe there's somebody where I think like this person doesn't like me, and then they indicate otherwise, or vice versa, and you just sort of like me in the like social friendship way. So yeah, I mean, all that said, I think that when people read fiction, there's this temptation to think, like, if a story or if a novel is at all autobiographical, the main character is a stand-in for the author. And in my case, I feel like, you know, I try to sort of inhabit all the characters, and there could be, like, an old grandpa who, like, says something that I would say or I would agree with, or, like, there could be two characters having an argument, and one is a woman who's like demographically a lot like me, like it's like a woman in her early 40s, and you know, she's educated and lives in the Midwest, and she's talking to a man who, you know, is younger or older or whatever, and so it would be natural for readers to think that like I and the woman are kind of aligned, and maybe we are in some ways, but the argument that she has with the man could be an argument that I've had with myself, and that I'm actually inhabiting both of their viewpoints equally.
Yeah, I understand that exactly. And the thing I do that's different, which is not very effective and probably not mature, is I tend to backstop myself. So I tend to have either a significant other or a good friend that I say, well, was that guy offended by what I said? Or what do you think that guy thought of what I said? Or if I... Or if I get drunk or something, you know, the next day, do you think what I did was really bad, or do you think I can, you know, that kind of thing?
Do you know what I read recently? That, of course, I read, you know, I linked to this through Twitter, that it was saying that almost like it's not your imagination. If you feel sort of anxiety after being drunk, that there are kind of physiological reasons why. And yeah, and it's not, and I think I'm not a huge drinker, in part because of that, because it's like, the for me, the line has always been really thin between being like, you know, I feel festive and uninhibited, and then, like, you know, in the morning feeling like, oh, God, like, I feel filled with remorse, even though nothing overtly appalling by most people's standards happened, but, like, I just feel kind of squeamish.
Yeah, and there's definitely a tipping point. It's like that. It's like Peter Fallow in Bonfire of the Vanities. He wakes up the next morning and he goes, I wonder what I did last night, and then gradually during the day, these events or things that he said just kind of work their way to the top of this muck, and he remembers what he did. That's how
you know, I confess, I have not read Bonfire of the Vanity. I guess maybe now would be a good time for a few different reasons. But
yeah, several different reasons.
I have not.
Yeah, it's a good book. I think it's one of his best books. So here's a way to get people to read the book. How did you decide you were going to talk about anal fissures?
I know. I assume you're kidding when you said
no.
I mean, I feel like, I think I've been like this for a long time, where, like, I think I just try to, like, make choices that I feel will serve the story and make the story come alive and, like, be the thing that the character would really do or think or talk about in the moment, and not try to, like, it's not my goal to make readers think, oh, Curtis isn't disgusting. Like, in a way, if someone's like, yeah, Curtis is disgusting, I kind of feel like, I don't care if you think that. Like, I mean, I kind of think that in my normal non-writer life, but as a writer, I'm kind of like, yeah, I don't care. Like, it's all subjective. And so I just think that it's like, you know, there's this moment where it's these two people who knew each other. They went to high school 25 years ago, and essentially, she's supposed to be kind of appalling him a little bit, and so she needs to say something socially transgressive, and I think anal fissures do the trick. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know, but it's really weird because I'm reading this other book now that I'm interviewing the guy next week, and he's talking about anal fissures too. So it might be like,
if you find a third example, it represents a trend. Wait, yeah. What's the other book?
It's a book about Native Americans, and I can't remember what the title is.
Oh, is his name Tommy Orange?
Yes, They're There. It's called They're There.
Yeah. I've heard some buzz about that book.
It's really interesting because it's a novel, but it reads like a bunch of short stories, but they're linked together, kind of like that movie, like Brewster McCloud, that Robert Altman movie. That you know, there's a whole all his movies were ensemble movies.
Uh-huh.
And eventually the characters kind of all come together at the end, which is a really hard thing to do.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, this guy's talking, this is a really overweight guy, and he has constipation, and he hasn't gone to the bathroom in a long time, and he does like everybody else does. He gets on the internet and looks up everything on WebMD and every other site he can find, and decides he has everything, and this is one of the things that he probably has. And so I guess that's enough about anal fissures.
Well, I guess it's a literary trend.
Yeah, like Seinfeld, the urban sombrero or something like that. But do-over is like, I mean, that's another one where, like, at the end, it's like when she makes that that phone call to him and says, I guess we're friends again, aren't we? And he says, I guess so. And then I got to wonder, thanks to you, are they friends again? Were they ever friends? And after all the things she said at dinner, how can she say they're friends and say, yeah, maybe we're going to watch that series too. I hear a lot of good things about it.
Well, I know. I mean, I think that there's, like, you know, like something I tell my children, I have grade school children, and I say, like, different people are different, which is sort of an idiotic, self-evident statement. And then I feel like sort of, is an explanation for everything in the world. And so I think that, like, there are people who can have very kind of, like, heated exchanges with other people and almost feel like that's a bonding experience. And then there are people who, if they're on the receiving end of sort of, like, blunt emotional statements or accusations, feel like, you know, the other person is dead to them, and it's like they'll never trust them again. And so obviously the woman in that story, Sylvie falls into the former category where she's comfortable saying kind of intense stuff and then thinking, well, you know, we've been through that together and now we've come out the other side. And I think the man who has a more sort of conservative sense of manners is not really in agreement with her.
Yeah, actually, you make him, I don't know. That's another one I'll just keep, you know, you're occupying a good deal of my time. Well, I'm occupying a good deal of yours as well. But I mean, when we hang up, I still am going to be thinking about these stories, which again, I think is a really good sign of a good author.
Yeah, I know. Well, again, it's another, I don't know, like parallel is when I was in college, sometimes, you know, I would take writing classes, and if I turned in a story, again, sometimes people wouldn't say, like, I liked this story, or I think you did a good job, Curtis. But if the story was about two sisters, they would start talking about their own sister or their brother or something like that. And it was kind of like it was obviously prompting something or causing them to reflect on their own life. And so, I don't know, like, I think sometimes it can be this good thing when, or maybe even almost always, when fiction makes you, I don't know, like, takes on this life of its own or makes you think thoughts that you wouldn't otherwise. And so, even though I also understand that it's not, I don't know, you seem a little unresolved.
Well, it kind of makes me squeamish about myself. It's like watching three episodes of Curb Your Enthusiasm, and my brother and I get really embarrassed because we remind ourselves of Larry David.
I know. Well, it's funny because my first novel, Prep, one of the people that I worked with at my publishing house would say that she felt like it was sort of, I mean, like, that's a pretty divisive novel in that a lot of people are like, oh, you know, I identified with this sort of neurotic, self-conscious girl in high school, and, you know, I didn't know that other people besides me had felt these feelings. And then other people would say, oh, she's so negative and annoying, and she has this amazing educational experience that she kind of squanders by just, like, not putting herself out there and not trying and befriending other people. And so, I don't know, like we bring so much of ourselves to the reading experience.
Well, so now that the book's been out for like over a month, do you find on the tour, or obviously since you're using Twitter so much, do you find that people are saying this guy was such a jackass, and other people saying, you know, I really, like in the last story, I really admired him for being polite after she says all this stuff?
I mean, it's been a little bit of that kind of commentary, but you know, for good or bad, there aren't that many characters in Twitter. So usually what someone would, like, somebody might ask one question or make one comment about sort of the collection as a whole rather than going into it like a, I mean, there are, like, sometimes people will send a link. There's a woman, I think a British woman, who posted a link to something she'd written where she said she really liked the story Off the Record because she felt like it was the first time she had ever read about a baby where the baby is developed as a character and not just almost like a, you know, prop device for the other characters to kind of have their own storylines.
But even the baby has its issues.
Of course the baby does.
No, babies are innocent.
I mean, you can be innocent and have issues simultaneously. At least in my universe, you can.
I guess so. As long as you take communion and confess, I don't know. But well, in order to avoid the tedium of continuing to have to listen to me ask you questions, I have one last one, which is: so, why did you take the title of the book from that first story? And where's the title supposed to take us?
So the story, the title of the book is You Think It, I'll Say It. And it comes from a story where a man and a woman are at a big anniversary party at a country club. And they don't know each other that well. And the man says to the woman, I'll think it, you say it. So the pronouns are slightly different. And she takes it to mean that she will... Oh, are you still there?
Yeah, we'll get rid of that.
She takes it to mean that...
Somebody else is using this line.
Is that me or you?
No, it's
are you
probably
getting another
us.
Call?
Yes, someone out there, some nitwit in the studio has done this for the past two interviews, and I don't know why. But I think they'll stop in a second. Just bear with me. We'll edit all this out. Nitwits. They are. Okay. Are you all right? Are you still there?
I'm still there. Okay.
Let's start over.
The woman in the story assumes that what he's saying is you should make judgmental observations about the people around us that are sort of things we both think. And then later in the story, the question is raised of whether she was in fact kind of speaking for both of them or whether she was only speaking for herself all along. And so I wrote this story and I showed it to one of my friends whose name is Emily Jean Miller. She's a fiction writer as well. And she said, you know, it's interesting because this is sort of concrete thing in the story, and then it's also a thing that you, Curtis, as a writer, sometimes do, which is like you say the thing that some people are thinking. I mean, obviously, I don't speak on behalf of the entire human race, but, you know, for some potential readers, it's like articulating, you know, some unspeakable or awkward or like granularly nuanced thing that they might not express themselves, even though they do think it. And so when she said that, I thought in that moment, oh my God, you've given me the title for my whole story collection. And my agent and editor agreed, and here we are.
Yeah, and I think it was a really good choice because, once again, I was following a track that turns out it was the wrong track. I was thinking this is exactly the way flirtation starts out, and I would think, wow, it's really, you know, I was playing words with friends with somebody and we started talking back and forth and chatting, and I said, are we flirting? And she said, I think so. But I was playing Scrabble.
Wait, okay, and then what? Keep going.
I can't because I have a different girlfriend now.
Oh, you mean, wait, so this is somebody who is not your, you are in a relationship and this is not your...
Yeah, it was before this, but it would still be awkward. I mean, well, now it is awkward. But,
wait, so you said, are you flirting? And the other person said, I think so. And then what did you say?
Then we went out on a date.
Oh, wait, sorry, the person is your girlfriend.
No, she isn't. No, she isn't.
Wait, but did you go on a date?
Yes. We had
and then what happened? Keep going.
No.
This is a story.
I'm making this up. I'm making all this up.
Wait, really?
No. No,
wait,
I'm
sorry,
not.
You aren't making this up.
All right, look, I'm not making it up. We did this, then we had a relationship based on this chat in words with friends.
A relationship in real life?
In real life, yes.
How long did the relationship last?
A while.
Weeks? Months?
A couple years. And
I guess you like asking questions more than answering them.
No, I'm answering all your questions. You don't answer all my questions at all. And also,
I think I dodge them like pretty competently.
Yeah, you do. But she and I are still playing words with friends. She's really good at it.
Wait, okay, she's not your girlfriend.
No.
You do have a girlfriend, but yeah. You're still playing words with friends with the person that you had the relationship with.
Yes, and the current person knows that I'm playing words with friends.
I'm okay with it. Different people are different, as we say in my family. And do you all live in the same city?
Yes.
And do you see the words with friends person in real life?
I haven't. I mean, I could, but I haven't. I find that
how often do you play words with friends?
Well, I don't like to play often with her because she's really, really good and she always beats me. Which kind of goes back to our relationship.
Very well of you.
Kind of goes back to our relationship in many ways.
Yeah, I guess. I won't. I feel like there's things that are like.
This isn't the way this is supposed to go.
I'm like biting my tongue. I feel like there's something to say that I think like one of my characters could get away with, but I don't think I can.
This is a good story.
But I think this is super interesting.
Well, write a story about it, then just make sure you acknowledge me because you know.
No, I will. Well, I like to like borrow from like if somebody says is it autobiographical, I'll be like, well, not autobiographical from my own life. But I think this is interesting. I hope you leave this part in because I think that honestly. Your listeners will find it genuinely interesting.
Yeah, assuming someone's listening, they probably will.
I think both of them will find it stupid.
I don't know whether it's good for you if people are listening or bad for you. But it will be on iTunes, and they can listen to the whole thing, everyone in the entire world. I even have
excellent.
I have
excellent. All, what, like 8 billion people. I think they'll really enjoy it.
Well, I have listeners in Tunisia and Singapore, so I figure, you know, that's pretty good.
Hey.
I know.
All right. Well,
all right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Take care.
You too. See ya. We were talking with Curtis Sittenfeld, who probably just ruined my current relationship. And her book is You Think It, I'll Say It, which is great. It's not a book I probably would have picked up on my own, just because, I don't know, because. But I'm so glad that Rebecca, my producer, gives me these books because they're excellent books that I might not have seen or might have simply just overlooked. Much like a couple of the ones that are coming up. So next we have Tommy Orange, who we discussed today, coincidentally, to discuss his debut novel, There, There, which is a linked series of short stories. It's actually called a novel about Native Americans. And then this guy, Abdi Nor Iftin, who's going to discuss his moving debut memoir, which is called Call Me American. So for a complete schedule, as always, you can visit us at our website, WellingtonSquareBooks.com, which is about my bookstore. You can listen to it on WCHE1520.com, or you can always, and this is the preferable way because it's there for the entire world, is download the podcast at iTunes or Podomatic. So thanks for being here this week, and I hope my current significant other will be here next week, and we will then see you on the Avid Reader.